Session number 27748, reel 6.
Reel 6, Richard Songer.
Yeah, we joined Ford, 804 Squadron, and the carrier was going to be Albion, and she was in Portsmouth Dockyard refitting, I think. And we then did virtually what we'd been doing at the Fighter Training Squadron, because we now had to learn to fight as a squadron. So we were going off in pairs, in groups, doing all the same sort of stuff again, bombing, rocketing, strafing, off the range at Littlehampton, which is just along the coast towards Selsey Bill. And you can't think of a more idyllic place to be doing that, because at the end of the day you were about a mile from the sea. You were, I think it was 45 minutes to London on the train. The place was surrounded by country pubs. It was just a perfect place. And it was an RAF station, I think, during the war. And so we lived in houses. They were semi-detached houses, and we each had like a bedroom in these rather large semi-detached houses. And our stewards had the kitchen, and they, you know, they did the domestic duties for us. And then just up the road, nice walk, was the mess, which was like a big country house, and it had tennis courts, and you know, and the nice bar and lovely food, and oh, it was the life of Riley. We realised we'd done the right thing by joining the fleet here.
You had motorbikes or cars? How did you get
Yes, I had a motorbike. That's right. I had a Vincent Rapide, you know, one of those 1000cc motorbikes. And then I changed that for a Sunbeam S8, and that was quite useful. You know, always ferrying people around, and it means you could go out for the evening to see friends at further in Hampshire or Surrey or whatever, and then get back as long as you were back by about 8 o'clock in the morning, when the sort of, you know, you'd go for breakfast and then find out what the day's routine was. And we had an air day. I remember we had an air day at Ford, where, you know, the usual sort of hoopla that you get at air days, and we used to fly in formation and then fly around. One of our guys for some reason liked flying upside down, so he used to do a circuit upside down. I can't think of anything worse. All the filth from the bottom of the cockpit showering around your ears. Yes, and, you know, there were side shows and that sort of thing. So we had a good time at Ford.
What about formation flying? How were you trained to do that?
Oh, all the way through our training, we'd done formation flying, right, starting with the Piston Provost. You know, you formated on others. You learnt that it was just a question of concentration. You know, the closer you are to the other aeroplane, the easier it is, because then you see the slight movement ahead or astern of the other one, so you're adjusting the throttle all the time, and you just concentrate on looking at the other aeroplane. You don't look at anything else. Occasionally you've got to look at your own quick scan to make sure, you know, you've still got some fuel left or whatever. But with the jet aeroplane, of course, you know, oil pressure is the problem with a piston engine. Just like in a car, if you lose oil pressure, you've lost the engine. Whereas your jet engine, it's unlikely ever to lose oil pressure, because it's not got bearings that are clapping out. So your jet aeroplane to formate is very nice. The only snag with it is that the engine is less responsive. You know, with a piston engine, you open the throttle, you get immediate response. You close it, you get immediate reduction in power. So in a way, it's easier to formate from that point of view, whereas the jet engine, because the response is slower, you've got to anticipate things more. But it's nice and smooth, and you soon get that. Formation flying is a skill which is learnt, easily learnt. Yeah. So we did a lot of that, because when you're on a carrier, you fly in usually in groups of four, with a space between the fours, and you fly past the carrier, and then you come round again, and the first four is then split up into one behind the other, and or rather an echelon, and then the first one waves and goes, you count three, then you go, and the next, and so on, and so on. So you to keep it all tight, you got to fly in formation and then peel off at a regular interval to get the landing pattern right. You don't want to be too close because they won't have time to reset the arrestor wires before you or the other guy's still in the way, you know. So you've got to get that formation idea quite early on.
So now you're in Lossiemouth, you're going through that training, it's this idyllic country life.
Oh, down at Ford, yeah.
Down at Ford, sorry. You haven't yet done the deck, have you?
No, we haven't. No, we still think this is in the back of our minds.
This is the idyllic. We're
working up, yeah. Yes. And so when we finish working up the ship, the day dawns when we're going to go to the ship. So the squadron, that's all the mechanics and the the squadron consists, you know, of supply people and the mechanical people and a few medical people and a whole unit. And so they're all packing their stuff because they're going to go by road and join the ship. And then we come along a day or two later because the ship's got to get to sea and it's got to work itself up. And so the squadron commander briefs us about what's going to happen and, you know, where we're going to be in the formation and who's going to land first and all this stuff. And by then your bowels are slightly watery. And then you go, and he says, first of all, I'm going to fly over at high level, maybe 10,000 feet, and I'll point out the ship out to you. And then we'll descend and we'll do this and that and the other, then we'll come in and break. And your first landing will be a touch and go. And then your second one is a land on. And if you don't make that second one, then you overshoot, you've got one more go, and then you go ashore. In other words, because you've had quite enough strain the first time. And if you go on, it'll just get worse. So that's what happens. And no hard feelings, you know, that's what'll happen. And then you come out the next day and we'll do it again. So we go out there, we're at 10,000 feet, and it's a lovely day, and we're looking down the channel. And then he points at his cockpit, you know, because we're all looking at him because we're in formation. He's pointing downwards, and then we look down, and we can't see anything. We're assembling a carrier. There's this very small ship down there, but that can't possibly be the carrier. But it is the carrier, you know. It's so small, we can't possibly land on that. Anyway, so we go, you know, we do go through the routine, we come down and we break, and then we come around and we land on it and we pick up the meatball and all the rest of it, and then we overshoot from the first one. I think the commander flying is on the radio and he's saying, okay, land next time, sort of thing, or you're a bit fast or you're a bit slow, just cut that down a bit, you'll be okay. So you're being talked round a bit, and then you come round and land on. And I can remember, as I taxied, as soon as you arrested, you know, your throttle's off, and then you've got to get the throttle on again. There's a man signalling to put your hook up. So you put your hook up, then he says, okay, and then you put the power on to get out of the way quickly, because there's a chap landing behind you. And I can remember as I was taxiing forward, the control column was shaking in front of me. I couldn't think what was wrong with it. What it was is my right knee was banging on it with, you know, the nervous apprehension or exhaustion or whatever. So we taxi forward, and then, you know, then there's great hilarity on board that night because you've actually done it, you know.
Once.
Yeah, once, but then, you know, it was the first time. It's going to be easier from then on. It's got to be easier from then on, yeah.
So now you're back on a carrier.
Yeah, now we're part of the ship.
And before you were a midshipman, now you're part of this eccentric group of...
Yes, we're now part of the flyboys. Yeah, that's right. And we're earning our pound a day pay and all the rest of it. Yeah, that's right.
So what was the routine then? I mean, what was the name of the ship?
It was Albion, HMS Albion.
A modern carrier?
No, she'd been built... her history is... I think she was built in the late stages of the war, not completed, and not completed about 10 years afterwards. So she was a sort of rusty old bucket, and then they'd resurrected it and finished it. But the advantage of that was that it was given the angled deck, which in her case just meant a little bit sticking out on the port side at the front, and the white line painted at an angle. Her arrestor wires, if I seem to remember rightly, were still at right angles to the original deck. But it didn't make any difference. But I mean, you know, all the angled deck basically consists of is painting a white line at an angle to the centre line, and that's all you needed to do really to save a lot of trouble.
And why? What was the? I mean, again, what was the broad difference between the?
Well, because you didn't have the barriers up when you landed.
So you went on and then parked out of the way.
Yeah. So you came down and landed on the angled deck at a slight angle, of course, and then you hooked up. And then went over there and parked there. So the next aircraft, when he was coming in, was not pointing at you. You were up the front on the starboard side, right-hand side. That's where the aircraft park was. And so if he made a mistake or had to go around again, he could just shoot off angling over the port side, nowhere near the parked aircraft. So the barrier didn't have to be up. You had barriers, but it was a soft barrier for emergencies, you know, somebody had an undercarriage problem or some other problem. So it was the same arms came up, but between the two wires, top and bottom wire, were ruched sort of nylon webbing. And so when an aircraft hit it, the webbing sort of pulled out of its little gatherings and slowed the aircraft a bit, and then in the end the aircraft was completely wrapped with this tape and came to a halt, hopefully without any damage. But it was not a thing, you couldn't have used that in the old days, because it had to reset after every... This was something, you know, if you had an aircraft come back and say, I can't get my port undercarriage down, they'd say, okay, you know, climb to 2,000 feet in orbit. He would climb up to 2,000 feet orbit. All the other aircraft would land on, and then, you know, the big drama would start. They would put the barrier up, well, they'd be there anyway, but I mean, you know, everybody was top line, and he'd come in and end up in the barrier, probably, but undamaged, other than his original damage, yeah.
So now you're on your ship.
Now we're on the ship, and we got the worst accommodation on the ship, of course,
yeah.
Because the ship's company have always bagged the best cabins, and we're in the multiple cabins, so we were a cabin of four of us, four lieutenants to a cabin, right under the flight deck at the stern. So when the ship got up speed to land on or take off, the whole place was shaking up and down about 2 feet. The mirrors would jump off the wall, and it was a bad place to be. But then it was, you know, it was our fault because we were pilots. That's why the ship was jumping up and down. So they reckon that was good enough for us to be there. Yeah, so that's where we lived. But we'd spend a lot of the time out of the cabin, because you wouldn't want to live in a cabin with four other people. You know, you'd go out of it as quick as you could.
And how many sorties were you flying a day, Dick? What was the first voyage, or what happened when you...
Oh, yes, we went out in the channel to work up, of course, because after all, we got to learn deck landing as a routine, not a one-off job. And we had to learn about, you know, ship's routine, and all those sort of things. So the ship went and, she went out in the channel. I think we went to Scotland, working up all the way, doing exercises. We'd go rocketing and shooting at targets towed by the ship. Target tugs would come out from the land, and we'd do banner firing at that sort of thing. It was all working up, and so the ship as well would be gunnery practice for the ship's guns. Everybody was, you know, learning, because they'd only commissioned the ship about 3 months before we got on board, so the ship's company was new. Everybody was learning how to use the equipment. And then when we came back to Portsmouth was when, and this was only 2 years after the Suez Crisis. This was 1958. And we were suddenly told that we were to fly ashore we were supposed to be going around the world on this trip, and we were to fly ashore, and then the rumour was that the ship was going to be a trooper. It was going to be used as a troop ship. And I wonder what on earth this was. And they, what they did is they welded eye bolts all over the flight deck, covered that with lorries, various army transports, and lashed all those down. The hangars they filled with scaffolding, with you know, sort of an 8-foot gap between them, and slung hundreds of hammocks. So all these soldiers and marines slept there.
Where were you at this time?
We were disembarked again to Ford.
And when you knew what was going on with the ship, because they were ringing up and telling you this is what's happening.
Well, yes, we'd heard from the ship that that was happening. Of course, the papers were very silent on this. We couldn't work out what was going on, and realised it was the same as the Suez business before. You know, the public was told right at the last minute, you know, that NASA was going to. But for months beforehand, we'd been ferrying aircraft, soldiers and everything, along with the French and the Israelis. You know, we were goading him into that.
But where were you in the Suez crisis? You were in training.
Yeah, I was in training then, so I was so busy with all that, I hadn't really thought much about it, but now I realise that here we were going to have another go.
So there was a feeling of, you were all talking amongst yourselves as pilots and saying, is this another Suez?
No, I don't think many of us were. No, I didn't have many people to talk to about that. I probably one or two.
But you'd been, after the Suez crisis, you were really ashamed by that?
Yes, I was ashamed by it. I realised that, you know, we weren't defending the country anymore. I wasn't a defender of the country. I was now part of a political tool, you know. I mean, I unfortunately had a naive view of politics up to this point, that, you know, it was always for the best and our country was, you know, a moral country. And I realised it wasn't. And that, you know, Anthony Eden was a very failed chap and shouldn't have been in charge. And that here we were going to do it again. And I didn't want to be part of this.
And what conflict was this?
Oh, this was... This was a likely conflict because of NASA had formed a federation with
Syria.
And was it something to do with Jordan as well?
Jordan and Iraq also were fighting. Yes. The Saudis were in the American pockets. So the whole area was hotting up.
Yes, it was hotting up, and we were obviously going to intervene, I imagine, against the Syrians and the Egyptians. But I've forgotten now, but I mean, at the time it was very important. And so I wasn't very happy with this.
So you're sitting in Ford. The ship has now sailed?
Yeah, she's gone. It only took them 9 days to get out, to take all these military people out to Malta.
So the ship was turned around from being a straight carrier to becoming a troop ship in incredibly short time.
Yes, and then took 9 days to get out there.
And took, what, 42 commando or something?
And yes, and a whole lot of, I mean, it's in that book of the crews there. It took army personnel and the commandos out there, plus loads of trucks and military vehicles of various sorts. And then they were all disembarked at in Malta. And then the ship stayed there while the Maltese dockyard removed all these ring bolts from the deck. I mean, it was a hell of a job for them because they'd been welded. You know, ring bolts are great clumsy things. And, of course, the ship never forgave them because the deck was never the same afterwards. And then we staged across Europe to Malta. And that was a really nice trip because it was then... Was it getting to be autumn time? And England was starting onto the winter. And we refueled at Orange and Rome. And Orange, you know, you taxied in, opened the cockpit, and this great blast of lovely warm air, you know, oh, was it France? And the guy was smoking a Gouloir, who was driving the fuel tanker, you know. We were now in France, we weren't anywhere else. And then the next refueling point, we flew as a squadron. but opened out, so you weren't pumping the throttle using extra fuel. It was at Rome, one of the airports of Rome, and our CO led us, of course, and he called approaching Rome. We could hear on the radio, of course, we were all on the same frequency, and the controller gave us permission to join the circuit, so we joined the circuit, and then he gave us permission to land, and I was probably about number three or four to land, so we were all one behind the other, and stepped up so you could sort of see over the shoulder of the plane in front, and the runway was covered in lorries and cement mixers, and you could see guys dropping shovels and running to the side, because it was a classic thing. It was a satellite to Rome Airport. You're talking to the controller. He's saying you're clear to land, but you're not actually in the right place. And so nothing was said, you know. We all overshot and then joined up again and then went to wherever Rome Airport was and landed there. But we nearly made a terrible mistake.
And whose error was that?
Well, it was poor old CO, yeah. Yes, but it was so funny to see all these guys, you know, jumping out the cabs of their cement mixers, right, because the stupid English were going to land on top of them. Yeah, so then we flew from there to Malta.
And you knew that something was up. I mean, was there any intimation in before that you might now be going into, you were flying over deserts? Any warnings given that
I don't think it was. I'm afraid my memory is very cloudy about what happened then and why, you know, from having been such a crisis, how it all suddenly died away again. But I imagine it was something like that. You know, it was all, and then probably the relationship between Syria and Egypt fell apart.
Yes, I think it did. And also I think the Russians had something to play with it, as they had.
Yes, maybe they told Egypt to cool it, just like, you know, the Americans told us to cool it when the Suez was on. But anyway, it went flat, so we just, well, the fact that the ship then transited the Suez Canal.
So you were back on board?
Yeah, we went back.
Drama was over?
Well, of course, the ship, having done all this work and rush and bustle, they were allowed some time off and they had to get the deck cleaned up. So we spent a nice time at what's it called, How Far in Malta. That was a naval air base, and we did more, you know, exercises from How Far for a week or a fortnight, which was very pleasant.
How far is, which country is that?
Malta.
Malta, sorry. Yeah.
I think it was called How Far. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then we went, took off, and the carrier steamed up and down, and we joined her again. And then she set off for Cyprus. And then there was all that EOCA trouble. And so we sort of steamed around Cyprus and made sort of menacing flights all over those Troodos Mountains. And the army was there, and we were...
What was the briefing for the menacing flights? What were you told to do?
I can't remember. I think we just were sort of, you know, we weren't told we were being provocative, but I think, you know, it was to sort of show the flag or intimidate EOCA that, you know, here was this huge military presence flying around. You know, we seemed to do a lot of flying around very rugged, inhospitable terrain, you know, which is where you imagine the guerrillas were. And the army liaison people called us in to do attacks on various places, but I think they were not. I think they were practice attacks, if I'm right. They distinguished themselves one day by calling in an aircraft of 809 Squadron, which was the other squadron. They were Sea Venoms, a twin crew version of the Vampire, really. And one of ours to the same target, but from opposite directions. So you've got these two aircraft diving on this target and then pulling out, and not surprisingly, they met. Ba-boom. And they all ejected and got out, but that was two airplanes written off. The dear old army engineered that one brilliantly. Then we set off on our trip we then went through the Suez Canal. So all that business about Nasser and Syria must have been somehow smoothed over because they took us through the canal. And this time it was Egyptian pilots and Egyptian tug crews, and the canal was wider and deeper than it was before, and it also appeared just as efficient, or even more so.
But it wasn't free.
No, it wasn't free, but it wasn't free before. But I mean, I should imagine we had to pay a bit more to go through this time.
You said £5,000, didn't you?
Yes, that's what it says in the ship's log, about £5,000, yeah.
And so where were you, where was the next move? Had you written the story of the letter, Dick?
Oh, yes, the letter. I suppose maybe it was, the trouble is now I can't remember what it was, but it was probably in the Mediterranean. I went to see one of my Dartmouth term, who was now a supplier of us on the ship, and said I wanted to resign. How should I go about it?
And what brought this out? That must have been an incredible thing for you, who's had such a good career, to decide this is it, I've had enough.
Well, it was just the fact that I was in the awful position that here I was in a frontline fighter squadron, and I was going to have to go and bomb and machine gun people that I didn't know, and I certainly believe didn't deserve this. You know, this was the, you know, I was in safe. What would I do if they then said that we got to attack Cairo? You know, I mean, these things happen, you know, in the military. There's no build up to them. You know, it's all, that's all decided by the politicians. And suddenly one day you're told to go and do this.
But surely that had been part of your training from the very beginning, that you were, is what you were there to do, to perform.
That's right. Yes, you're absolutely right. But I hadn't realised that then, you know, I had a naive view of politicians and the government. The government, really. I didn't, you know, imagine the government was some omnipotent organisation. It wasn't subject to human frailty and all the rest of it. And it's taken me all this time to realise, you know, which is pretty obvious at the beginning, but I hadn't. I'd only realised now that it was just an aggressive arm of government, and that's how it was used. Nobody thought, oh, I wonder if the chaps think it's right to do this. Oh, well, that's what they're paid for. They've got to do it. You know, and I realised that I was in that position. I was taking the money, and therefore I had to do this.
Was there anyone in your squadron who felt the same? Did you talk to anyone about it?
No, they thought I was all barmy.
But you say you did talk to them.
Oh, well, you see, I had to, I went down to see the supply chat and said, well, you know, it's very difficult. They won't want you to leave. You'll have to, and he gave me a whole series of reasons why. It was very, I can remember the Navy was a shield and a sword for England, and, you know, that's what it was. But I wasn't prepared to, I no longer thought we were a shield. We were just an aggressive sword. And he said, you want to put in some social stuff, you know, so I had to make up all sorts of, well, not make them up, but, you know, say most of my friends weren't in the Navy, I was interested in the arts and all this sort of stuff, you know, which was beside the point, really. But he said, you've got to build up a big case. The other thing he said, yes, he said, I won't help you with it. He said, it's got to be a naive letter.
This man was a contemporary of yours.
Yeah, he was a contemporary, but he was in the secretariat branch, the supply branch, and so he was, he was trained in that sort of thing. I mean, you know, they wrote the captain's letters. They, you know, they were like PPSs, you know, that for the ship's senior officers.
Mustn't it have been a long night of the soul? You just make it sound
so
easy.
It went on night. Yes, but this is hindsight. We're talking 55 years ago.
I know, but even so, you must have stayed awake at night.
Yeah, yes, I did. Mostly, you know, I couldn't think what I would do if we were shot off in the morning and were to go to bomb Cairo. You know, was I going to bomb my ship? You know, what was I going to do? Was I just going to drop them in the sea? You know, it was horrid. And when you're in that situation, the best thing is to resign. You know, I didn't want any part of it. So I wrote this letter, and they were very, I can remember the commander